Hi, I'm Donna O'Toole and you're listening to my exclusive Winning Awards podcast. Over the years, I've had the pleasure of supporting entrepreneurs, business leaders and teams to win the most prestigious awards in the world. I've seen firsthand how receiving awards and recognition has motivated teams, solved problems, supercharged brands and raised profiles, helping businesses to grow and do even more good things for their employees, their industry and their community. In this podcast, I'll be sharing valuable awards insights, tips and inspirational stories to make sure that you get the recognition that you deserve so that you can go on and achieve your dreams. So what are you waiting for? It's time to start winning. Hello and welcome to another episode of my Winning Awards podcast. Today I have the great pleasure of welcoming serial technology entrepreneur Michael Tobin OBE. Born in the back streets of Bermondsey, Mike is known as the maverick former CEO of the Telecity Group. He is also widely credited with having been instrumental in creating the digital infrastructure of the internet in Europe. Michael's outstanding achievements earned him many awards during his career, including Broad Group's Data Center and Cloud Influencer of the Decade, Smith & Williamson's Top 25 Power Individuals of Industry, the Ernst & Young UK IT Services Entrepreneur of the Year three times running, and Data Center Europe Awards Lifetime Achievement for Services to the Data Center Industry, amongst many, many more. In 2014, he was recognized by Her Majesty the Queen with an OBE for his services to the digital industry. And following his unwavering dedication to the data center industry, was well deserved. His day at the palace, though, was a long way from his humble childhood beginnings that included suffering periods of homelessness, violence, and dodging petrol bombs in Rhodesia. Today, Michael works around the clock in his NED and chairman roles and undertakes charity missions that continue to test his limits. His latest missions to support and empower young and vulnerable people have included running 40 marathons in 40 days for the Prince's Trust. And in January this year, he finished an arduous trek to the South Pole supporting the brain tumour charity to beat brain tumours in children. Mike has just released his third book called Lifting the Floor. And in Mike's own words, it's the first book ever to reveal the incredible stories hiding beneath the tiles of the data center industry. This book is unbelievable. It's a business book that reads like a thriller, and it takes us from blackmail and betrayal to some of the biggest boardroom battles of all time. So welcome, Michael.
Thank you very much, Donna. Hardly recognize myself in that.
I don't know how you get any time to do anything. It's madness. No, thank you very much for coming on today. It's great to have you here. So you've obviously got quite a story, and there's no way we could pack that all into one podcast. But what would be really nice for our listeners today is just maybe if you could just tell us, start with your kind of childhood story and how you then eventually got working into technology and data centers.
Yeah, I mean, it's so, you know, born in the East End, as you mentioned, and my dad was in prison when I was born, quite a violent gang, very nasty to my mother. And so when we had a moment, a chance to escape back when I was about seven, we escaped to Africa to try and escape him and the life that we had in East London. But when we got there, we basically it was frying pan to fire because we were in a civil war, and you know, we ended up being petrol bombed, as you say, a few times, and one destroyed the house, or shot at 13 times. One got me in the leg, and then we basically got back to London when I was about 12, and because everything was taken from us, literally at the airport when we were leaving Africa at the time. We came back as refugees into our own country. So lived in a squat in Stockwell. We used to make money by sort of breaking into condemned houses, waiting for demolition and finding things that we would then sell in the markets, in particular pianos and things that people couldn't you know, get out of the houses when they moved. So we survived doing that. And then I got an apprenticeship in electrical electronic engineering, and basically that sort of set me on a path, I guess, into technology, even though I still didn't really understand what I was doing. And it was with a company called Rockwell Automation. It made sort of industrial robots, and then you know, started going for jobs that I knew I had no right to get, and was getting a few, and ended up in Redbus. And Redbus was a business that was the kind of the beginnings of a data center organization. That data centers are where the internet lives, right? So when we think about what we do on the internet, we think about cloud and all that sort of stuff. And you know, you think put your business in the cloud. Well, all of that actually lives in physical buildings, and data centers are what those buildings are. And ended up in, you know, in this thing that I probably wouldn't have chosen, but you know, made the most of, and here we are.
Amazing. What such a journey. And I was just thinking, actually, that when you were talking then, what a great shout out. What a great example you are for apprenticeships.
Well, you know, I've supported apprenticeships throughout the years, and you know, several years ago they tried to make a comeback, I think. And you know, it's what is interesting is obviously not everyone can be academically capable, right? And yet the government or our environment suggests that we all need to have a degree when we come out of finishing education. And you know, having a degree in sort of underwater basket weaving isn't going to help you get a job, right? and so you know, whilst it's very important for people to have degrees in academic capabilities, there's also an argument to say that you know, that there is a need for, you know, for skills, right? And I think that, you know, in Germany, for example, they look at apprenticeships as an alternative higher education, whereas in the UK we look at it as an alternative to higher education.
That's a really good point.
Right? But it almost creates a second tier value to apprenticeships, which shouldn't be the case. And I, you know, the value of an apprentice in a company these days, if they're managed properly, right? I mean, I remember going around, you know, like every single department of a business, right? And doing, you know, from you know, quality assurance to finance to goods in to, and working on the shop floor, literally on a production line, you know, doing the same thing monotonously 8 hours a day. And only when you've done everything in a business do you really understand that business to the point where, you know, you can add value. And, you know, when I left, I was somebody that people came to say, this process isn't working. Tell me how we can improve it. Because I was able to see the process from all these different departments. And there's very few people in the company that work in all these different ways to understand how the company itself hangs together.
Yeah, fascinating. And it's interesting, actually, because I was having a conversation the other day with someone about business GCSEs in business and A levels in business and degrees in business. And whilst I'm sure there's value to them along the way, I do think that as an entrepreneur, and you're an entrepreneur, I'm an entrepreneur, you kind of just jump in and get on with it. And actually you learn business along the way.
Well, I mean, I mentioned it in I think I've mentioned it in a couple of our books, my books that I've done, but I never recruit someone on capability. I always recruit them on attitude, because I think, you know, capability is you know, if they were doing the same job before and they've moved, why have they moved, right? I'd rather have someone that has the right attitude and give them something they've never done before than to know someone is very good at some role but has a bad attitude, right? And so for me, it's all about attitude. I don't care whether they've demonstrated their capability or not in that particular aspect. I'd rather just have the right attitude and let them loose.
Yeah, I completely agree with you, actually. Every time I've recruited on my intuition, not on someone's skills, but on my absolute intuition that they just have the right attitude and they will just do and work to everything that you want them to and do the absolute best, it's the right thing to do, absolutely. So as a young person then, you've gone from such a difficult childhood and such a difficult background to then getting an apprenticeship. And you know, something that we talk about, actually somebody else said this recently, is that one of the things that's most valuable to people, more so than money, is recognition and actual recognition of what they've achieved. So when do you think then you first kind of felt like you were getting some recognition and actually that could drive you forward?
Well, I've been quite a, I guess, somebody that always wants recognition. I've probably since childhood missed love, right, as a child, and you know, always hunts out types of sort of recognition in various ways. And I think to a certain extent, many of us are like that. We look for alternative reward, and you know, money is great, right? Because money is a form of recognition. It, you know, if you get paid lots of money for doing something, it's because people see you as valuable. Mm. But actually, you know, sometimes it's just about wanting to sort of a long-term piece of paper in your hand, or a long-term, you know, block of perspex that you can say, look at this, you know. And I think almost all of us will accept that that is something important to us over time. Mm-hmm. And I think the other thing about awards rather than rewards, is it's usually our peers that recognize it rather than simply just getting money from you know, mm-hmm. an employer. It's your peers saying, okay, we're all in the same boat here. We're all in the same industry, and we recognize that mm-hmm. you would do very well. And that's, to me, that's you know, that's an interesting thing. And I remember in the Data Center Awards, it was always the fact that everybody that I knew, my competitors, my partners, all these different things, different sort of entities, but all knew how tough that industry was and how nascent it was at the beginning and how, you know, how it evolved. And they were recognizing my contribution to it. And I think that was the key. It was the peer group mm. recognition that was so good in those awards.
Yeah, fantastic. And so when you, so it was sort of 2002, early 2000s when you started in the data center industry. And I know, and anyone who doesn't know needs to read Mike's book about exactly what went on in that time, because it's absolutely mind-blowing what could be going on in behind the scenes at that time. So you went through like such a roller coaster, and you like were literally fighting fires constantly, but also then eventually turned that around. And then when you merged and became Telecity Group, that's when things changed for you. And that's when we saw your recognition starting to come to fruition. And I remember you told me a story about a time. I mean, if there's anyone who knows how to get to a black tie dinner for an award, it's you. And I remember you told me about a time. Tell us a story about the time when you
were. Yeah, well, I mean, I was skiing, and it was the awards company, the head of it, who I knew quite well, because they did some research. They had a research division as well, so we used the research. And he phoned me up and he said, "Look, you are coming to the awards dinner, aren't you?" And I said, "Yeah, of course. Yeah, I bought a table and, you know, it's a support thing." And they said, "No, but you must make it." And I was skiing, and our flight got cancelled and then rearranged. And in the end, you know, I think I got back, but I literally landed at about 7 p.m. when the event was starting, right? So I landed at Heathrow. The event was in the West End, probably Grosvenor House or somewhere. And I thought I can still make it, but there's no way I can get home, get into my black tie and then get there. So I literally just went just to show my face, to say, look, I promised to be here. And I turned up in ripped jeans and a t-shirt. And as I walked into the room, and I was just going to say hello to a few people, as I walked in the room, my name was being called out on stage to come and get the kind of the gong of the year. You know, it was like the biggest award. And it was Ed Byrne, the comedian who was doing the awards. And literally, as I walked in my ripped jeans and t-shirt, he said, come on up and get the award. So I went on stage, and everyone was kind of like laughing and the whole thing. And old Ed Byrne goes like, you know, you could at least made a bloody effort, you know. And I said, well, look at you, because he's a scruffy character as well, right? And I said, well, come on, you know, you might have put a black tie on, but you know, you could have washed your hair. But you know, that was the, you know, it was a bizarre thing. But I got a kind of a reputation then for the sort of maverick approach. But people assume that it was my intention to turn up, you know.
You've been waiting around all day in your jeans.
Yeah, exactly. Some sort of anarchistic attack on kind of Broad Group or whatever the company was that made the awards. But no, it was just simply, you know, I was trying to fulfill a promise, which was I would turn up. Didn't have the time to get changed, and then I understood why they wanted me to turn up, because obviously they were giving me the award of the evening. So.
There we go. So the moral of that story is, don't worry what you're wearing, just get there.
You know, the award isn't for your black tie. The award is for the days and weeks and months of effort that, you know.
Yeah, exactly. So this Maverick title has followed you around, hasn't it? Everywhere you've been. But I think that comes from some of the kind of management stories and also that you've talked about in your first book as well. From back in the day when you sort of had teams to motivate, inspire, lead, and you used to kind of do all kinds of exciting things with them, like getting them kidnapped.
Yeah. So, I mean, yeah. So the one of the challenges was that, bringing two sort of competitive businesses together, if you imagine back in the day, you know, IBM and HP both make computers and suddenly you put them together and the people, the head cultures and, you know, trying to get them from being competitors to sitting on the same side of the table overnight was quite challenging. And the first time when I told my team that we were going to merge these businesses, they were quite worried. They were thinking like, you know, okay, well, there's two of everything. So, you know, when there's two people, one job, someone's going to get sent back in or whatever. But so I took them actually to Scotland and just on the north side of the Firth of Forth, just as you cross the old road bridge, not the new one, but when you cross the old one, there's a massive aquarium. And I took them up there. They thought they were going for a whiskey tasting. But we pulled up and I got them two by two to get in their wetsuits. And they said, they kind of, what on earth are we doing here? And asked them to get into this massive aquarium. And when you're in it, you think you're in the open sea because it's so big. And as they were getting in, of course, they then started to see the shark fins in front of them.
Oh, my goodness.
And they were going down with sharks, no net, no cage, no protection. They were just in there with giant sharks. And when they came out, I said to them, how did you feel when you realized what you're about to do? And they said, oh my God, it was so terrifying. And I had to, you know, it wasn't possible to sort of really, really understand the fear that was going on in my brain. And I said, well, how did you feel when you were down there with them and you were seeing the sharks? And they said, I was still scared, but it was kind of exciting when I was going through it. And I said, how did you feel when you came out? And they said, oh, amazing. It was a life-changing thing. I don't want to do it again, but it was just so. So I said, every time you have, every time you fear something, remember that process, right? So we always fear things in advance of it. To a disproportionate degree of what the risk is, because we look at the negatives and we look at the sort of the risk side of it, and then invariably, right, it's something that we learn from. It's something that actually is interesting to go through, and when you come out of it, you're always a better person because you've gone through such a challenge. And so whenever we look at sort of something that makes us fearful or afraid or we're worried about, you know, remember that fear is simply it's like paying interest on a debt on a drawdown you haven't drawn yet. You know, it's an unnecessary emotion because it's about the future. And if you can mitigate the risk of the future, then you should do it. And if there's nothing to mitigate the risk of the future, then why worry about it? Because it is what it is. So there's no value in worry.
No, that and takes an awful lot of self-discipline and self-control, though, doesn't it, to stay in that present moment and not fear what's coming up.
You know, I mean, I talk about it, but I still worry about the future sometimes, and I have to, you know, you have to catch yourself constantly doing what you truly realize is nonsense. Because fearing the future is nonsense. Either deal with it or do something to mitigate it, or there is nothing you can do. And either way, in no circumstance should you waste energy worrying or fearing the future.
That's a good message for right now, actually, isn't it?
Everyone's in challenging times, right? I mean, you know, there has never been a moment as challenging for businesses generally as today is. Yet, you know, we still, you know, here we stand, you know, we're listening to podcasts, we're doing these things, and we've just gone through 6 months of the most bizarre environment, you know, that nobody could have, you know, if I'd have written about this last year, everyone would have said that's stupid, you know. So we've just gone through it, and you know, we've kind of hustled through. people have found it difficult. People have lost their jobs. But actually, you know, we still stand, we still live, and we'll get through. But we need to think about the positives. We need to think about, okay, what do we do tomorrow that improves my position, right? So how do we fix the negatives in life? But just worrying about it doesn't fix it.
Yeah, no, of course not.
Got to take action.
Actually, it's been such a fascinating year in a strange way, because I've been thinking about it actually from a kind of perspective of thinking about this podcast, thinking about recognition and how that comes in different ways. And, you know, took for granted our National Health Service over the years, you know, here in the UK. We're so lucky to have it, and yet we expect it, we've taken it for granted. And then there's been such a shift in attitude, in a good way, this year, where we've actually given recognition to the nurses and to the doctors and to all the key workers. You know, the standing outside every week clapping, actual physical, just, you know, we're not giving them anything personally, but we're just showing them that we respect them, we care about them, we're glad and thankful and grateful for everything they're doing for us. And that's been a huge step forward in recognition and in understanding that actually that means something.
It's like a giant awards program, isn't it?
It's amazing.
Well done, everybody. You know, the industry is... You know, when you think about what they've done, they stepped up in terms of a fight against something. So now, I think people almost feel like COVID is part of life now, right? But back then, nobody really knew how devastating it would or wouldn't be to people, right? And people were getting it, were dying, and it's less now, right? So people are getting it and surviving now, but at the time, when it was, you know, nobody knew just how serious it was, that everyone believed that it was very serious. And yet they stood up and went into work every day and faced this fear, right, head on.
Yeah.
And that was the kind of amazing thing about the NHS. It was like they were saying, yeah, it's my job, it's my responsibility to save people. And that was never recognized before. And I'm obviously very, very glad that they have got the recognition. You just kind of wonder how long it'll be before we forget again.
Yeah.
Scary.
Yeah, thing. And let's hope it's actually, we never forget, and actually it's more of a shift in our behavior than it is, going back and forth and back and forth. Okay. You've been doing some volunteering for the NHS as well, haven't you?
Yeah, I've reached 2,500 hours now of
amazing
of volunteering, and it's not big. I mean, a few things were sort of like taking groceries to people that were vulnerable and couldn't get out in the early days. Now it's more about people for just phoning them and talking to them about their frustrations, and it's usually elderly people that are stuck indoors. Have very little contact, and they moan about things. Right, nothing I can do. Right, it's like my staircase is wonky. You know, it's okay. But they want to moan. They want to express, and they want people to. It's very interesting because they want people to appreciate the challenges. Right, and I think all of us in life just want people to appreciate. Situation and the circumstance, and you know, awards are a similar thing. It's an appreciation, right? And yet, these people I talk to as a volunteer, and all they want is someone to listen to them and to say, yes, I do understand. And sometimes I'm able to give advice, but many cases it's just
acknowledgement, isn't it? It's acknowledgement of their pain or their issue or. Even just that they're on their own, and that's terrible and hard enough as it is, and
they phone up and they want the volunteer app sends me a message. I call them, and we sit and we chat for half an hour, and then they're fine.
Amazing. Well, that's one app that's been working, so that's good.
Well, I think that one, that is a really interesting one because, I don't know, I can't remember the numbers now, but like, you know, within 24 hours, like a million volunteers.
That is incredible.
And that's a good way of, you know, back in wartime, right? It was how many people signed up to for national service or, And you kind of go, well, this is today's modest way of trying to be part of a greater cause. You know, it's like, yeah, fight this enemy called a you know, virus, and people wanting to sort of sign up to the army that's going to fight this, you know, in whatever way they can.
Yeah, exactly. Well, talking about fighting for causes, that's something that I know is a real passion of yours as a big old philanthropist, but also someone who likes to push themselves to the ultimate limit. So this year you trekked to the South Pole, didn't you?
Yeah, I did that. And it feels such a long time ago, but it was only I mean, it was the most brutal thing I've ever done. You read about it and you prepare in a certain way. And I was going to the gym and things like that. But when you get there, and what I didn't realize, Antarctica is as a continent bigger than North America. It's massive, right? And just getting there is an experience, right? So you have to fly down to South America, you go down to the end of the tip of South America, then you have to wait for windows in the weather, and you get a Russian cargo plane across to the continent. And then even then you have to get, and that's a 6-hour flight. And then even then you have to fly 6 hours to a point where you can start trekking. And we did like 150 miles, 200 miles at the end to the South Pole. And then when this plane just drops you off in the middle of nowhere, literally in the middle of nowhere, and you can look all around you and see nothing other than snow and nothingness. And it's minus 40 degrees, minus 50 degrees, and it's 24 hours daylight. And there's, you know, there's nothing can come back, right? I mean, that plane could not have come back and picked us up again if there was a problem. There's no helicopters. You're at 10,000 feet everywhere. So it's like being a high altitude with no, you know, you have to acclimatize in terms of altitude sickness and everything else. And we were walking. At the beginning, we did a mile a day. And then, you know, that was how hard it was. And towards the end of it, we're doing 9-10 miles a day, which already, you know, sounds like nothing, but it's dragging a 200 kilo sledge. It's really arduous. And, you know, the things that we experience in terms of kind of frostbite and hypothermia and collapsing and yeah, it's just incredible. But I'm so glad I did it, but I just don't want to do it again, that's for sure.
But do you get to plant a flag at the end?
Well, you know, when you get to the South Pole, is actually something that's probably about 2.5 feet high, which is a silver ball on what looks like a kind of a barbershop kind of, you know, like a white and red sort of thing. And that's it, right? It's this little thing. And there's a few flags around it of all the people of all the nations that have representation on Antarctica, the research center there. But it's quite a, you know, when you actually get there, it's quite a sort of, it's almost disappointing.
Anticlimax.
All that, right? Great. Now what do I do? And then you finally go back again. Well, you go into this kind of temporary hut, which has got heating, and you know, and I took a bottle of whiskey with me, and we cracked it with a bottle
good
of whiskey.
Thinking.
Yeah, and then we just drank this bottle of whiskey, and you don't know what time it is because it's 24 hours daylight, and you know, you don't know whether it's daytime, nighttime. You know,
you can't text anyone.
There's no connection. There's nothing. It's just completely kind of. Okay, that's it. Right, let's go.
So that's a bit of a, I think you've got to go for self-recognition in that area, haven't you? Like what you've achieved, because there's not banned at the end.
That's the thing is when you come back, right? And bizarrely, I came back and I had personal problem there because my sister sadly passed away within a week of me coming back, and that was challenging as well. And the whole kind of event just got forgotten because then we were into COVID. Mm. And I had no sort of, there was no kind of big fanfare. There was no sort of this amazing thing you did. Mm. And you know, what we did was we raised £1 million for children with brain tumors, and that's the key.
Yeah,
but there was no party. There was no kind of welcome home. There was nothing, and that was kind of odd in itself. But the whole kind of post event just got swallowed up by events.
And
I think that's probably something, you know, looking back on it now, right, you you it's interesting to think how important recognition is to reward people's effort. I think that's super
absolutely important.
And that was lost.
Yeah. the whole point of recognition from a formal perspective, actually. Yeah. And this actually, I'll talk to you about this because obviously you've got your OBE, is that it should drive you forward to do more good things, but it should also demonstrate you as a role model and inspire others to do good things. So the whole point of recognition is to create this kind of virtuous circle and to keep inspiring and driving people forward. Because if no one ever gets recognized for doing anything, then they lose motivation and they lose inspiration. So back in 2014, you were recognized by Her Majesty the Queen with an OBE for your services to the digital industry, which is no mean feat. And for a lot of people listening to this, you know, we will never experience receiving such an amazing honor. So can you tell us about how that came about? How did you find out that you were going to be recognized?
The funny thing is that obviously, you know, you don't know, right? I mean, you don't know that it's happening until it happens to you, and you get the letter from the palace saying that you know, first of all, the letter comes and it says, if we're minded to give you this award. However, we want to ask you, if you get this award, would you accept it? Because what they don't want to make you an offer, and there are some people in the past have said, I don't want that.
Some rebels.
And they don't want to be in that position. So they say that we're minded to think about giving you this. And if we were, then would you accept it? And then you have to respond saying yes or no. And then you don't know anything else again, right? That's it.
Okay.
And then there's another letter comes that basically says, congratulations, you know, you've been awarded this. And so there's two moments, one that you're not quite sure, but you probably are going to get. And then another one that says confirmation. And then the one that says confirmation is still about 5 weeks from the time of when you get it. And it says, you know, you're going to get your head chopped off by the Queen if you tell anyone. So keep it a dead secret for 5 weeks.
That's a heck of a secret to keep, isn't it?
It is. I mean, you want to say to everyone, look, I'm so proud I've got this. And of course, you're not allowed. And then the day before so mine was the New Year's honours list. So on I think it's the 30th of December, 2 days before, they give it to the newspapers. And then the newspapers can publish the list. But until then, you're not allowed to say anything.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, you're very proud to have it. And the other thing as well, you can only take three people to the palace. Right. And I said, which of my children would you like me to leave out? You know, okay. And I said, okay, leave it with me. And we'll try and find, cause obviously not everybody takes three. So, somebody might take two. And I was nabbing one of those places, and then they said, yeah, okay, you can take
them. Oh, that's good. Yeah, you don't want that. You have to put that poor child in therapy for the rest of their life.
To be fair, I mean, it's a long, you know, it's like an, you know, it's like watching your kid's graduation at uni, right? So, you know, all these
to watch everyone else's as well.
And there's beautiful music playing, but you're sitting there, you know, waiting, you know, and I'm obviously in the queue effectively to come and sort of take my award. And it was Prince Charles, and I do a lot of charity work with Prince Charles and Prince's Trust and all sorts of things, British Asian Trust. And I meet Prince Charles quite regularly. And when I went up to get my award and he saw me coming up, he went, oh no, not you again. Right. And I said, you can talk. I was hoping for your mum. Right. And we burst out laughing, and everyone's going, what's going on? What's going on? Because it wasn't very formal until then. And then, you know, Prince Charles and I just start laughing, and everyone was going, whoa, what's going on? Quite funny. But it's a great honor to receive that. And it's also, I mean, you know, there's no way that I could have done what I did in a business sense without, you know, all the people around me, you know, in every walk of life, you know, both in a private sense, in a business sense, you know, they keep you going in the tough times. in the business, they are the engine of the business. You know, I'm just there as a kind of a figurehead in a way. And for me to get that award was, it was fantastic, but it was also, I felt a little bit guilty because I was getting the recognition of so many people's hard work.
Mm.
Of course they, you know, and that was an industry award. It was services to the digital economy. And it's such a broad kind of title that so many people have contributed to that success. And yet I was getting it. And it was very humbling to me. It was,
I'm sure.
Yeah, you know, I felt like I should kind of almost do more to give back.
Mm.
You know, and a lot of what I do in charitable works is giving back, but it feels, because you know, it comes from this sense of not embarrassment, but sort of, you know, there are many people that deserve this, not just me.
Well, I think it adds a sort of extra layer of responsibility, doesn't it, almost, as to the people you've worked with, but then to the industry ongoing as well. Yeah. It's not like, oh, okay, I've done that, now move on, I'm not really ever going to have anything to do with that again. You sort of, and but that is part of the purpose of these awards, is to actually keep you interested and keep you motivated and keep you moving forward. And that's something now that you do as a chairman and NED, and you support other companies coming up. Tell us a bit about your work there.
I do a lot of mentoring, but chairman roles, non-exec roles are also super important because, you know, having spent most of my life being a CEO, running businesses, you know how lonely it is as well, right? Because you get these recognitions, right? But also, you know, there are times when you take, you know, you have to take the punishment too, right? So, you know, you've got to get the hit over the head if the share price doesn't work out, or, you know, there's no one else to blame. And I think that sometimes it can be a lonely place. And the way I work as a non-exec now is I give a lot of freedom to my management teams, like 100% freedom, but I'm always there for them to kind of come to if they want to, a sounding board or a, you know, a bit like my sort of NHS volunteer, you know, they can phone me up and moan at me. that's part and parcel of my role as creating. The best thing a non-exec can do in business is to create a safe kind of buffer zone for management to do their thing. And if management can't do the right thing, then you've got the wrong management. But if you've got the right management, then the only, you know, why would you try to do what they just give them the space and give them the kind of breathing apparatus, if you like, to do the right thing. And I think that that's kind of what I do now. And I've been on the other end of meddling non-execs, and things like that. And I think that we need as kind of that kind of Ned environment now. We need to just believe in our management teams and give them space to deliver, and more so than ever before. I mean, this is the toughest time. This is the toughest time, right? And you know, faith and support is better than chastising and swearing at people. And, you know, we all know what's going wrong and what's going right. But having the ability to just say, guys, you know, we're all in this together. We support you. We're here to help. But just, you know, we'll get through this.
But you took a business through, you were obviously within the data center industry during the 2008, 2009 kind of recession when that hit then. Yeah. And there will be a lot of people who were then, and they are back in this difficult scenario now. And we're constantly hearing on the news and everything, you know, we're comparing to these other big recessions. What do you think the difference is now to what you had to deal with then? And then what would be your kind of message now for business leaders and entrepreneurs of how to get through it, because you've come out the other side on many occasions?
I don't really see much difference, to be honest. I think, you know, the thing is that we all these tough times, you know, we've got through, right? And we are going through another one now, and we will get through it. And I look at challenges in life as the opportunity to differentiate yourself from your competition. So if everything is good, right, we feel like, yeah, that's great. But actually, everyone is feeling, yeah, that's great. So value comes, you know, character value comes from when you get knocked down. because the ability to get up each time you get knocked down is the thing that differentiates you from everyone else at that point. So every hurdle, right, instead of seeing it as a hurdle, instead of seeing it as a problem, you get over the hurdle and then look at that as a barrier between you and everyone else that still needs to get over that.
Mm.
So if you look at challenges in life as the opportunity to distance yourself from your competition, that gives you the momentum to get over the hurdle and look at the hurdle as a positive.
Yeah. Right?
So that's the key, is I think every time you see a challenge, and we end up being so engrossed in the challenge, right? We don't see the challenge as an opportunity.
Yeah.
But if we can get over the hurdle, that hurdle is the differentiator between you and everyone else.
Yeah, I completely agree. Actually, that's something. So when I'm judging on awards panels, people always say to me, oh, what questions do you ask? What questions will the judges ask me? And I always say my favorite question to ask is, what's been your biggest challenge? Because so often, actually, people try to portray this amazing business story of perfection. And everything's gone perfectly and nothing's gone wrong and we're completely on track. And I just think, no, that's not true. Because it just can't be true. It never is for anybody.
Never is. And if that's the case, then, you know, they've got an almighty bang coming up sooner or later.
Yeah, exactly.
Because 90% of success is luck.
Yeah.
Okay? And luck can be improved with hard work. Mm-hmm. And, you know, doing all those good things, right? And you seem to be get luckier, right? Was it Tony Jacklin, I think, that he said it, you know, playing golf. He said, the funny thing is that, you know, the harder I work, the luckier I get.
Right? Yeah.
But the point is, you have to take circumstance, okay, and work with it.
Mm.
And, you know, the successes that are coming out in industry, that are coming out post-COVID, are people that have looked at COVID and gone, oh, my God, potentially my business is dead. However, I'm going to pivot.
Hmm.
I'm going to take this and I'm going to reprocess my business. I'm going to redirect my business to be COVID functional, right? Hmm. And where, you know, where people have taken that negative and turned it into a positive, you know, some people in hindsight will say, oh, that was lucky you had that. No, it wasn't. Yes, it was. No, it wasn't. Right. So you kind of take these opportunities and you look for the opportunity and in what may be the most dire circumstance, and then people say that was lucky.
Yeah,
but it's like high jumpers, right? I mean, you know, there's a differentiation between high jump and pole vaulting than most other sports. In most sports, it's like, who's the fastest, who can lift the most, who, you know, it's the first one. But high jump, always the success always ends in failure, because that's the moment you've achieved the maximum you can achieve, and then you've hit the bar and that's it, you're done, right? So it almost like your success is achieving a negative.
Yeah.
And what is important in success for me is you learn nothing from getting it right every time. Right?
No, that's very true.
You don't know whether that was lucky or not.
Mm.
But when you get it wrong, you absolutely 100% know that was wrong.
Mm.
If you get it right, you might know one of many ways to get it right, or you may have been lucky on that day or whatever, but you know when you get it wrong that was 100% the wrong thing.
Mm.
So the learning of life comes from the painful lessons, the negative lessons. And the more negative lessons you can get, the more appropriate and more accurate you can be in getting it right.
Mm.
So getting, you know, having setbacks, having hurdles, for me are just simply honing in on success.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you're absolutely right. And actually, you're so right, because our challenges are what make us at the end of the day.
Absolutely.
And yeah, they do differentiate you. And you know, we're all going to have them this year. We're all going to have them next year. But who knows? You know, there's a different challenge for everyone every year, isn't there, at the end of the day?
It's
just that this is a collective challenge.
and look, you know, at the same time, right, you can say, you know, there's been, in, you know, the whole finance industry in 2008, they had a massive crash, and, you know, there were bankers becoming Uber drivers, and you know, but people get through, right? Now it's an entire world rather than an industry. But actually, you know, in a way, that's better than just simply you having bad challenges, right? It's actually, we're collectively getting through this. Great. So the playing field is leveled again. right? Yeah. It's no kind of just me that's having this problem. Mm. Everyone is in the same boat. So what do I need to do to differentiate myself again?
Yeah.
And we're in a better position now with a global problem than we would be with an industry problem or a cyclical problem. No, we've all just reset.
Mm.
So it's actually, you know, get off our rear ends and actually do something will make a difference to us because everyone's in the same boat again.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, that's a good message for everyone. Get off your rear end, do something. And there will be positive times ahead.
Absolutely. At the end of the day, right? So, you know, we all get up every morning, you know, we all kind of deal with whatever we're dealing with. And these are maybe different challenges, but we've got through challenges.
Yeah, yeah. Absolutely. We are confidence, isn't it? Yeah. Confidence, self-belief, confidence. Positivity. Yeah, positivity. Well, thank you, Michael. This has been such an interesting, it's a really interesting chat. And I know your stories and your journeys, and it's no wonder you have so many books because you've got so many amazing stories to tell. So for anyone who hasn't yet read it, please go out and I'll put a link as well in our text to Lifting the Floor because it's absolutely fascinating. You will gasp with horror and you will really laugh too in this book of Mike's incredible journeys through the data center industry, which is an industry now that we all in this day and age massively are relying on to operate our entire lives, basically. So thank you, Mike. I really, really appreciate your time today and look forward to speaking to you again soon.
Thanks, Donna. Appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to this episode of my Winning Awards podcast. If you enjoyed it or found it helpful, please share it on Twitter and LinkedIn. And if you have any questions, please head over to craftedbyaugust.com where you can find out more about winning awards and contact me. On the website, you can also take our free awards test, which will identify your award strengths and tell you how likely you are to win. I really hope you've been able to take away some ideas today so that you can go ahead and win awards, have an even bigger impact on the world, and achieve your dreams.